It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about Trempealeau County's decision to enact a one-year moratorium on new frac sand mining operations.
But first, we explore the fascinating world of cryptozoology. Stories of creatures like Bigfoot, the abominable snowman, and the Loch Ness Monster are kind of part of our collective experience, despite the fact that the existence of these creatures hasn't been proven.
But where did the ideas behind these mythical beasts come from? Why do we continue to be fascinated by them? And of course, there's the big question, are these creatures really out there?
Our next guests have written a book about the subject. Daniel Loxton and Donald Prothero are the authors of Abominable Science, Origins of the Yeti, Nessie, and Other Famous Cryptids. And we welcome them both to the program now. Daniel, hello to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Donald, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for inviting me.
So first off, let's talk about the different perspectives that the two of you come at this from. Daniel, you're a staff writer at Skeptic Magazine and the editor of Junior Skeptic. And Donald, you've been a paleontologist for years. You've published numerous books and scientific articles on this subject. Donald, can you talk about your different backgrounds and how that maybe worked to your advantage in putting the book together?
Sure. As you say, I work for Skeptic Magazine, and I come to the topic of cryptozoology as a longtime fan of monster mysteries and cryptozoological goings on. I've been following these things since I was a kid, and it's what got me into the skeptical literature originally. So coming back to this topic now is something like coming full circle back to my first love.
And my background's a bit different. I'm a professional scientist. Background in paleontology, but also in biology and geology. But one of the things I felt that was important to bring into this entire discussion, which is something that's often neglected, is the kind of scientific constraints that are important to talking about whether these things are real or not, and something I have formal training in.
Now, Daniel, tell us, why do you think that the persistence of the belief in creatures like this, like Bigfoot, like the abominable snowman, the Yeti, Loch Ness Monster, why do these, I guess they're myths, why does it still persist?
That's a bit of a million-dollar question. We spend a whole chapter delving into the subculture and the psychology and the sociology of cryptozoology, and the short answer is that it's not really clear why these myths persist. Part of the answer has to be just their inherent plausibility. These are creatures which could easily exist in many cases, are very similar to creatures that did previously exist in other geological eras. They're creatures that are consistent with what people know from their everyday experience, which is that, new animals are discovered all the time. There are animals which are, these hypothetical creatures are ones that can fit easily into a scientific framework. All you have to do is find them. That turns out to be the trick.
It's also interesting, though, to think about it. We are one of the first cultures in the last few decades or century or so, which has been sort of defined by rationality, by science, by skepticism, and not having a built-in belief in a mythology of monsters. And a lot of people have argued that the human species has a need to believe in the mysterious and the monsters and the strange, unexplained things. And we're the first culture not having that. And so some would argue this is their way of doing it.
I was watching one of the cable channels with my 8-year-old. I can't remember if it was Discovery or National Geographic. And there are whole shows devoted to people who are trying to track down Bigfoot. And, according to the two of you, there isn't really any plausible science. And yet, we really cling to this. I mean, can you trace a little bit the journey of our belief in Bigfoot in America, Donald?
Yeah, there's a lot in there that Daniel especially tracked down on the topic of how the story grew, but it's more that we found a lot of people saying a Bigfoot is sort of equivalent to, going out and hunting for deer or walking in nature. These people seem to like the idea of giving them an excuse to go out in nature and commune with nature and test their mettle against the wilderness, but they give an excuse as I'm out there looking for Bigfoot, I'm doing research. I was surprised how much that was a theme in a lot of the Bigfooters community.
Well, we know from polling data that a lot of people, a large percentage of the population, will at some point in their life be curious enough about monsters to read a website or pick up a book on the topic, perhaps slip on one of those shows you were talking about. And when they do, inevitably, the message they hear is that these things exist. You know, there'll be a little bit of token skepticism in there, but whether you're watching, you know, Bigfoot hunters stumble around in the dark with night vision goggles, or you're picking up a book at your local library, the answer is always that monsters exist.
That's one of the things we try to do with this book here. We've got, and there are a handful of books out there, for example, that debunk individual cryptids like Bigfoot or books about Nessie. This is, I think, the first book that's been comprehensive in that we talk about the entire methodology of science and how cryptozoology has trouble doing a good job of being scientific, and then talk about individual cryptids and the scientific method applied to them, and then also talk about the field of cryptozoology and who are the people in this field.
Now, cryptozoology is what? It's a study for these mythical creatures?
Yeah,
cryptos means hidden life, in, literally in the original Greek root. So they usually define it as some kind of a creature that's never been formally discovered, but has sort of a mythological, you know, basis. People have claimed to have seen it, but no one has yet found a real specimen.
Now, Daniel, I want to ask you, I think I'm talking to the right guy. Didn't your parents think that they saw Bigfoot?
They thought that they saw current West Coast, Pacific Northwest version of the great sea serpent of the North Atlantic, the classic sea serpent.
Oh, the sea
with
serpent.
The multiple humps going through the water. And in those days, we were hippies. We lived in a travel trailer. We would just pull down to the beach. And, they were sitting up in bed one morning while drinking tea, and a sea serpent just cruised right by their window. So they ran out down the beach barefoot after it. And, even looking fairly closely at it, they weren't able to be sure what they were looking at. It looked very much like a sea serpent. And so growing up with that story, of course, it sunk the hooks of cryptozoology very deeply into my
Daniel, these are your own parents. You don't believe them?
Well, I certainly did believe them. I believe they, to this day, I believe they had that experience. The question is not what do people, do people see things, or is it all in their heads? Clearly people do see monsters just as they see ghosts and see aliens. But the question is, what experiences create that, you know, what phenomena lie at the root of these subjective experiences of things that go bump in the night?
And Daniel has stories, too, because he's spent his life as a shepherd as well up there in the British Columbia forest, and he's seen his share of Bigfoot stumps, I should say.
That's true, and a lot of stumps that morph into bears and bears that morph into stumps.
Well, what about that? What about eyewitness testimony? I guess in courtrooms it used to be the gold standard. Should we be thinking twice about what we believe people say they see, though, Donald?
Yes, it has been a sort of like 20-some years now that psychologists have done this research and shown that eyewitness testimony is very unreliable and very likely to be false because people are not tape recorders or video cameras. We have a great tendency to see just a part of something, and then we'll have our cultural expectations fill in the details, or we'll catch a glimpse of something in the dark or in the peripheral vision, not see much of it, and then we'll paint a story in our memories that we saw much better than we actually did. And so we have a number of anecdotes in the book of, you know, people whose eyewitness accounts turned out to be completely wrong to tragic results, like a father shooting his son because he thought he was a hog when he was out hunting hogs, that kind of thing.
Hmm.
And this is a very common experience. And so courts of law now, by the way, are gradually shifting away from relying too heavily on eyewitness testimony, and defense attorneys certainly are aware of this stuff. The defense attorneys have made big hay out of discrediting eyewitness testimony. So it's really disappearing in lots of ways from the credibility ledger of law, and certainly in science as well.
Now, the two of you have been studying this for a long time, and you've been poring over the data and the eyewitness accounts, the stories that have come down. Have you ever come across any where you did have to kind of scratch your head and say, okay, that one is a little hard to dismiss?
There are many unsolved cases. You know, say you come to me and you say, I saw Bigfoot. Well, I wasn't there. I don't know what you saw. Maybe it was a Bigfoot. It's consistent with your sighting, probably, that it could have been a Bigfoot. But there are other things that could have been consistent with that sighting as well. And so, you know, I can't dismiss what you have experienced. You occupy a privileged vantage point as an eyewitness. But I'm very well aware, I have to be aware, that there are many things that can create an experience similar to what you're reporting. And, you know, what I can do is invite you to sit down and try and get to the bottom of it.
And as scientists, this is one of the problems we have, is that this kind of testimony may be very convincing to the person who experienced it, but it can't be transferred very well to anyone else who wasn't there. And so, and we know because it can be very easily colored or tainted by cultural things or by false memory, that it's very hard for scientists to take any of that witness seriously. And that is the vast majority of all so-called evidence of the cryptids is basically eyewitness on top of eyewitness.
And it's important to realize that, you know, what the eyewitnesses we're talking about are not kooky, strange, crazy people. We're just talking, these are just, it's the nature of being human, of looking at things a great many times as you go out in the woods or look out at the water. We just expect a certain number of false positives because people see so many things.
You know, the other thing about this is that it's fun to hear these stories. Whether or not true, watching those TV shows is fun and hearing people's stories is fun and being a little scared is also fun. Is that part of why you wrote this book, Donald?
Daniel,
do too. Yeah, that's part of it too. And it's really, that is in fact a major factor because just the last couple of months now, we've had several examples of this, especially this couple of shows that were on Animal Planet about the mermaid, which was all completely faked. And of course, it explained it was fiction in tiny type at the end, but it was played for hours and hours on these television shows and people believed them. And then they had, numerous Bigfoot shows and numerous shows about these other cryptids on these things. And they know from experience, anytime they run one of these things, they get some of their highest ratings ever. And just a couple of weeks ago, they ran a completely fake show about the giant extinct great white shark and made claim it was real and alive today. And all these people bought into it, and they got their highest ratings ever. So for a TV network, there's nothing to be gained by being honest or truthful. they have a strong incentive to create fantasies and appease people who want to believe these things.
And what were you going to say, Daniel?
I was just going to say the fun factor is definitely the hook that keeps me interested in monsters. I write mostly for kids, and so monsters are a great topic for kids. And, for people who are kids at heart like me, they're still great topics. You know, monsters are awesome. I hope that people will come away from this book, from Abominable Science, with is with the idea that mysteries are awesome, monsters are awesome, but solutions are awesome too. You know, it's said that Mark Twain said, supposing is good, but finding out is better. Well, yeah. Solutions are they're a lot of fun. It's fun to see Scooby and the gang chase the mummy through the old castle, but it's fun when they rip off the mask and it's old man Jenkins too. So I just don't accept the common sort of debunker equals buzzkill narrative. I think that mysteries are fun. I think investigating is fun. And I think that finding answers is fun, too.
Well, we're talking right now with Daniel Loxton and Donald Prothero about their new book. It's called Abominable Science. And we want to hear from you. Are you a believer in the existence of cryptids like Bigfoot or Nessie? And why do you believe in them? Why do you want to believe in them? And why do you think we're so fascinated by them over the years? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Daniel Loxton and Donald Prothero about their new book, Abominable Science. And we'd love to hear from you. Do you have a favorite sort of mystical or imaginary creature that you wish were real? Maybe it's a Bigfoot. Maybe it's a Loch Ness Monster. Maybe you saw something yourself that made you scratch your head. You can call us up at 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we've got a comment here from Max on Facebook. And he wonders about Reinhold Messner's book, My Quest for the Yeti, and wants to know, do we know how the scientific community and skeptics interpret his conclusions that the Yeti is actually just a Tibetan blue bear? What do you think, Daniel?
Well, his conclusions have been a little bit difficult to understand. He seems to go a little bit back and forth about what he has experienced. But the bulk of his work clearly indicates that the Yeti is and should be associated with the brown bears of the Himalayas. That is very, very consistent with what we know from the rest of the literature. It, It is pretty much uniformly clear across the history of the Yeti, although this is one of Don's chapters, that bears are heavily implicated in the case. It's probably not a coincidence that this kind of bear-like creature is so often reported in bear habitat, much as the bear-like Bigfoot is also reported in bear habitat.
Yeah,
well, it's good.
Yeah, there's some sections in Meister's book where he has the guides take him to the den of the Yeti, and sure enough, it's a bear in there, an angry one.
All right, let's go to the phones. We've got Ryan with us in Rhinelander. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
Hi, what's up?
Well, I've got a Bigfoot story. I grew up in Rhinelander, and I believe in it because I think I've seen one.
Tell us about it.
Well, I live out on the east side of Rhinelander, about 5 miles out by the Moen's Chain. And our next door, well, I should say our neighbors who live down in Indiana have about 94 acres back there. And we walk our dog back to the cabin, and we kind of keep our eye on it. For the, you know, the neighbors who live in Indiana. Well, this is about 2 years back, and was probably in fall, and I was walking the family dog back there, and I'll tell you that I went down onto the dock, and I saw a large, like, black-looking creature, and it was about probably 30 yards down the shoreline. And, you know, I saw it put its big hand into the water and pick up a fish and take a bite out of it, and he kind of threw the fish tail to the side, and I yelled at it, and it kind of went off into the swamp, and there it was, gone, just like the 30-point buck.
Hmm. So you don't think black bear?
I don't think so. It must have been at least 7 feet tall.
So interesting stories like these. Donald, what do you make when you hear a story like that? What do you make of it?
Well, there are lots of people who say things like that, and the problem we know is that a lot of people are having difficulty when you actually go back and study the details of this later on. There's often ways in which you can misestimate size. There's often ways in which what you see in the way of a behavior turns out to not to be what it is. We can show, for example, that in the case of some other cryptids, people said, oh, well, I saw this sea serpent-like creature rise out of the lake. We go back to the spot later on, discover that, in fact, they had missed. You know, the picture shows clearly they were completely mistaken about scale and distance. And that's a very common problem that humans have.
And what about you, Daniel? What do you make of stories like that? Do you still enjoy hearing them, even though, you know, as a scientist, it sounds like you don't quite believe them? But what do you think when you hear one?
Well, I'm not a scientist myself. I'm an artist, and I've become a science writer, but I'm a humanities guy myself. When I hear stories like that, I am extremely interested. I love to hear these stories. And, you know, regardless of what was at the root of that story, it was an experience that somebody had, which is important to them. And if it's important to them, it's important to me. I want to hear about it. There's only so much I can do with a story like that, because it's very difficult to corroborate. And because we are aware that there are many, many ways for people to be mistaken. And this is not, you know, this is not something that I'm immune to by any means. You know, in my sheep herding career, it's something that just happened constantly. I can remember looking up and seeing 5 or 6 sheep eating grass just right close to me, like, say, 30 feet away. But, you know, when I got a better look a moment later, it was one very large grizzly bear. You know, and a grizzly bear looks a lot more like a Bigfoot than it does like 6 sheep. But it was easy for me to make that mistake anyway, because I'm human, you know. People do.
What kind of reaction have you gotten from, I guess, both the scientific community and the community who are cryptozoologists, who are out on the hunt for these creatures?
Very good overall. The scientific and skeptical communities are quite excited about it. The cryptozoological community so far has been very kind, for the most part.
Not totally, huh?
You know, cryptozoologists are people who generally like science, who think of themselves as fair-minded, science-minded people, and so they're generally willing to engage fairly. On the other hand, some of them are very, very invested in some of these mysteries, and it can feel like a very kind of personal attack when someone just sort of looks at it and concludes in good faith, but concludes that there's nothing there. It can feel very unfair.
And we have one reviewer on the Amazon.com site for our book who gave us a one-star review and got all frothed up because he's a great believer in a particular famous Bigfoot film, the Patterson-Gimlet film, and convinced that all is all he needs to prove his story, and ignored everything else he wrote in the chapter and everything else in the book, basically. And so naturally, he was very, very uncomfortable and unhappy with what we wrote.
Well, no matter the case, you know, it's been a lot of fun to talk to you both today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Daniel Loxton and Donald Prothero. They're co-authors of the book Abominable Science, Origins of the Yeti, Nessie, and Other Famous Cryptids.
Coming up next, we'll talk about Trempealeau County's decision to enact a one-year moratorium on new frac sand mining operations. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll be talking with about an exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum showcasing African-American artists from around Wisconsin.
But first, we're talking to a WPR reporter about news out of Trempealeau County about frac sand mines. Even though Trempealeau has already approved 26 mine sites, the county board just passed a one-year moratorium on new frac sand mining operations.
The moratorium was passed by unanimous vote, with two members abstaining.
Here to talk about the story is Rich Kramer, WPR news reporter. He joins us from our Eau Claire studios. Rich, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So why is Trempealeau County placing this moratorium on frac sand mining now?
Well, the person that brought the resolution through the Board of Health there said that the mines weren't kind of playing by the rules. She said that there have been a lot of violations, and while they have some fairly strict ordinances on what mines can do, they really haven't addressed health enough. And this board supervisor, Sally Miller, said that her office had been getting something like 800 comments and complaints from residents who are worried about frac sand mining hurting their health.
Now, as I've heard it, this meeting has been described as contentious, and then the vote was unanimous. So what was going on there on Monday?
Well, there was some jabbing back and forth. There was three members that were obviously not in favor of a moratorium, and they seemed to be in favor of kind of a laissez-faire, economics and letting the companies do what they will, and they're in support of jobs as well. The people that are against the moratorium are worried that this will hurt economic development in the county. And then you've got the people on the other side that are against frac sand mining and are very, very concerned about impacts on their quality of life. So there was some jeering coming from frac sand opponents that were watching the meeting whenever anyone spoke against the moratorium. And there was some jabbing back and forth between supervisors.
So now there's this one-year moratorium, but 26 companies have already got permits to start their operations in Trempealeau County. What does it mean for them?
Nothing. The 26 permits that have been approved, the permit holders will not have to, they can begin mining whenever they like. There's, according to the Land Conservation Department in Trempealeau County, on their website, it shows that 11 companies are already in process or processing. From what I've heard on the ground, though, there's only actually three sand mines that are active, mines and processing centers. So anyone that's got a permit already to mine frac sand, they are unaffected.
Now, Minnesota mining companies apparently have been moving over to Wisconsin. Do you have a sense about whether a lot of these companies have come over from Minnesota?
Well, I've heard from a local attorney here in Eau Claire who really represents the frac sand industry. His name is John Bailing. He's told me that absolutely his office gets calls every day from companies that were looking to mine in Minnesota, but they are coming to Wisconsin because Minnesota has what he would call burdensome regulations and unreasonable requirements for companies to mine there.
Now, it seems as though health is at the crux of this moratorium, with a lot of people being concerned about health effects of frac sand mining. What exactly are they worried about?
Well, the main thing is dust. This silica sand has a kind of a binding, you know, when you mine it, the silica sand itself is kind of round and a perfect, a very hard substance, which is ideal for extracting oil and natural gas. But when you mine it, it creates crystalline silica dust. And this dust has been proven by the EPA and is actually regulated by OSHA within confined spaces. So indoors, this dust has been shown to cause silicosis and is also a carcinogen.
What is silicosis?
Silicosis, basically these little chunks of sand are so small that you breathe them, they get into the deep lungs, part of the lungs. It's small enough even that this sand or these particles can get into the bloodstream. So silicosis, it builds up in the sand chunks get in the lungs, and they're sharp, and they create scarring, and it gets so bad that eventually you die because you suffocate.
So the worry then is that these particles are in the air and people are breathing them in. It's not a closed environment. It's in the outdoors, but I guess it sounds like residents are concerned anyway.
Yeah, they absolutely are. And that's because it's not a closed environment, that's where the science kind of falls short. People don't really know what in ambient outdoor situations. There's not a whole lot of science, there's none in Wisconsin, that show whether or not it has an impact on health. Some states like California and Texas do regulate silica dust to a certain size, the particulate matter like of 3 microns or more. But Wisconsin was petitioned, the DNR was petitioned by people that were concerned about this to study it and create a rule. And the DNR basically said, we can't use these other states' rules because we are a different state. We have different situations, different environmental situations, and the rules on hand are good enough. So the DNR has not acted yet.
So now what does the board plan to do with this one-year waiting period?
They are planning to use this as kind of a chance for them to catch their breath because they've been permitting a lot of mines. This will give them some time for the Board of Health and the Health Department to conduct studies to find out whether or not this ambient silica dust can cause lung damage. And also there's concerns about water quality, whether chemicals that the mines use to treat water that they use to wash the sand is going to leach into people's wells. This is going to be like a fact-finding mission during this year period. The Board of Health is tasked with creating a committee that will come up with studies and conduct them to find out whether or not frac sand mining is harmful for health.
Now, how challenging will it be for a single county to conduct scientific experiments like this when this is really a national issue that has been looked at the national level?
It has. It's going to be challenging. I mean, any kind of study costs money, and both sides are going to be very, very critical of whatever results come out. The industry says, you know, one thing, the opponents of frac sand mining say another, and this study is going to have to come out with proof that is undeniable from both sides.
Now, there's another twist to this story. The Trempealeau County Board supervisor is being accused of using his office to promote his business interests in the frac sand mining industry. Can mm-hmm. you tell us what's going on there?
Well, it was a charge that was actually a charge of an ethics violation that was brought actually by the same woman who's been pushing for this moratorium. She basically accused one of the supervisors of dealing himself in to the sand business and using, like you said, his office to further his own interests. This person, this board supervisor, admitted that he does have some business interests with frac sand mining. He has worked with companies, but he has abstained. He says he claims he's abstained from all the votes, so therefore there's no misconduct. But this individual has pushed, supposedly, the board to try to allow frac sand companies to mine sand on public county-owned land. So that's, I think, the crux of it.
Now, this has obviously been a hot-button issue in Wisconsin for quite a while now. Do you see other counties following suit and doing what Trempealeau's done?
There have been a number of counties that have already enacted moratoriums. They all do it a little bit different through different ways. In Trempealeau County, it was the Board of Health that has brought the moratorium and has pushed it. in other counties, it's been through different committees or just different processes. So there's been a number. Well, Clare County, Dunn County, Pepin County, I believe maybe Pierce County, just a number of counties, towns, and villages and cities have enacted moratoriums in order to study the issue and just slow down the growth of this industry.
Well, Rich, thank you so much for filling us in.
Thank you.
That was Rich Kramer, WPR News reporter based in Eau Claire.
Coming up, we'll talk to a photographer about an exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum featuring African-American artists from Wisconsin. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Back when we first started our show, we spoke with artist Hank Willis Thomas about his work on display at the Milwaukee Art Museum for the 30 Americans exhibit, a display of 30 contemporary African-American artists.
That exhibit is also accompanied by the Wisconsin 30, which includes works from 30 African-American artists in Wisconsin.
Both of those shows will be wrapping on September 8th, but before they close, we're going to be speaking with one of the Wisconsin artists involved.
Joining us now is media artist Portia Cobb. Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
So tell us about your work on display at the Wisconsin 30 exhibit. What can we look for?
It is a digital photograph. My work is in documentary. Generally, I work in video. I've kind of stepped out of the frame. I used digital photography to kind of map what I was shooting in video originally. But I was shooting in a place that was rural that had sweeping landscapes, and I wanted to capture that. As I started to look at my photographs as kind of a chronicle or log, I found them to be very interesting, and it, for me, created a new body of work.
And why did you choose that scene?
I have an attachment to South Carolina. My mother is actually from there. I'm very interested in the Gullah Geechee culture. And I started looking at land and issues of ownership in land. And there's a phenomenon there called heirs property, and there were issues around heirs property. So originally I started to do a documentary about my family, how they acquired land in the 1870s, to kind of follow the genealogy of land. When I got there, I found myself immersed in what was going on. And so it sent me on a new journey, basically.
Yeah, well, talk about how you opened up those conversations with your relatives to get that information and to start telling that story of your family's journey.
It's very difficult. I find that it's better for me now because I've spent a significant amount of time there. I did a one-year sabbatical there between 2009 and 10. So I had to gain the agency of being there. Even though I was there, they knew I had a connection. Relatives who are my mother's first cousins would sometimes tell me, untruths about the land and also about paying taxes on the land. So I became a taxpayer. So I put in every year, and I try to get other family members to put in on our end because we were the family members in their eyes who left, who abandoned it. But the heir's property is kind of a covenant, and it seals the land as belonging to all of us. And sometimes it goes down a different path. If somebody, a developer, sends one of us a letter or somebody who's not attached or has no interest and offers them a little bit of money, it then buys out their share. So my documentary took sort of a different form when I became involved because I was in the frame, not behind the camera.
Yeah. Well, when it came to selecting what to, bring to the Wisconsin 30 exhibit, how did you decide what photograph you were going to submit?
I had been working on a series. I actually submitted I think they asked us for about 10 images, if not, maybe 5. But I had been working and printing my images one by one. I would sit and counsel with another artist. And we would look at the photograph and talk about the merit of the photograph. And I knew that it was telling a story, but I wanted it to convey something even to people who were outside the experience. I don't know if they individually do that. I think when they're shown in series that you start to see the documentary story come together. But of all of the photographs that I submitted, Book of Boots is what I'm calling that one. It is a photograph of a from the waist down of someone who's just stepped out of the creek. South Carolina and the Low Country, where I spend my time on Yonge's Island, people often go into the creek to harvest oysters or to crab and to shrimp. And so he's just stepped out, and I was interested in his boots because of the debris from the marsh, or what we call the pluff mud from the marsh was still on his boots. And so all the other images right now are of land. There are some activities that are taking place that I also photographed that have subjects in them, but a lot of the photographs that I was focusing on was of land, so I submitted those. But Booger's Boots was the only different one, and they selected that one for the show.
Hmm. So art is a very subjective medium, and I'm wondering from your perspective, how do you ensure that someone sees what you want them to see when you put together a piece like that?
I think it's difficult, and I think that my task, and I think what I've kind of reinvented my genre as, it's a composite genre, and so I'm calling it ethno-folkloric because it is about the lore of place. Most of my work is about home and place, but what I'm feeling is that my connection to it gives me a certain inside point of view. Sometimes I have to tell the story to get them to really look at the photograph, you know, so I'm not sure where my photographic body of work is going to belong. It may have to become something that also may have to become something that has some kind of essay. Maybe it's essayic in that way to get people to really invest in looking at it. I think that there is more work like mine that is looking at the South and places that are disappearing, and I think that that's become its own sort of impulse in documentary photography right now.
Well, tell us about the larger project that your piece is a part of, the Wisconsin 30.
Oh, it's really a privilege. It's an honor and a privilege to have been selected. I think every artist in this show can name two or three other artists that they feel could have been in the show. But it definitely has brought us together, and some of us have exhibited before. One of my colleagues is in the show, and that's Iverson White. We both teach in the Department of Film at UW-Milwaukee. And there are a couple of alums in the show, and there's a graduate student in the show who has great experience. His name is Mutope Johnson. It was another person who was involved. If you go to the larger show, the 30 Americans, one of the voices that you hear as you wear the headphones it takes you through is a professor here whose name is Shalene Green, and she's in the art department. So we all belong to the school, the Peck School of the Arts. And there are younger artists in the show that I had not met, were not aware of, and I'm really impressed with some of the work that I'm seeing. There's a young man whose name is Christopher McIntyre. And he sees himself as sort of the glue to everybody. He sees himself as sort of a promoter. But the art of that, you know, like really relating to the artists on their level and being among us. I could name others. You know, I think that it's very diverse and disparate in some ways because many of the artists are from Milwaukee. A majority of them are from Milwaukee. So I'm kind of in the mix because I've lived in Milwaukee and I've taught here for 22 years. Mm. So I know that my work sort of looks outside of Milwaukee. So I think that that's sort of my difference in the group.
I see. When we previously spoke with Hank Willis Thomas about his work in the 30 Americans exhibit on this program, his work commented on how advertising affects the African-American experience. But does the Wisconsin 30 experience speak to the African-American experience specifically in Wisconsin, do you think?
I think that many of the representations are, but I think that our work is so diverse. We don't always address maybe the obvious. There's some really interesting imagery in here that maybe is coming from someone's experience of, being a trained artist or not being trained, I think there are portraits in it, you know, that don't necessarily reflect what we know of the black community, but of somebody's proximity to that experience. And there are certain images that do definitely call up what we know about Milwaukee. If you're looking at the Bronzeville, you know, rejuvenation that's happening right now, this week, in our neighborhoods, you see those imageries. You see, like, someone looking back on the past of what Milwaukee was, and then you see imagery that's definitely called up that it's about the future. You know, people looking at the blight in certain neighborhoods and foreclosures that have been kind of, you know, overbearing in some neighborhoods as you drive through them. You don't see them on the beaten path, but when you go in, artists here are seeing that, and they're representing whatever is coming out of that.
Well, Portia, thank you so much for telling us about it.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Portia Cobb is a media artist, and her work is on display at the Milwaukee Art Museum as part of the Wisconsin 30 exhibit. We posted her picture, Booga's Boots, on our Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about just what Chris Christie is doing right, according to our guest.
And we'll also talk to a journalist about her book on education in other countries and why America is so far behind on the international stage.
That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll take a closer look at Wisconsin food traditions that are being featured at an Appleton museum. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.